I'm pleased to be joined today by Dr. Walter Veit. He is a lecturer in philosophy at the University of Reading, working in philosophy of mind, cognitive and biological sciences, applied ethics, and animal welfare. He's the author of Philosophy for the Science of Animal Consciousness, which we're going to be talking about today. Walter, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
How did this book come about, Philosophy for the Science of Animal Consciousness? It sounds like a big undertaking.
Yeah, I didn't write it out of the blue. Essentially, it's my PhD thesis turned into a book. And yeah, I suppose in a way, there's two ways of describing this trajectory. One is that at some point during my PhD, I saw a couple of people near me have it publishing their PhD thesis books. And I was very impressed. How did they manage to do that? How did they find a publisher, an editor willing to undertake such a project? So I was lucky that, for instance, in Paul Griffith's philosophy and biology lab at the University of Sydney, there were multiple people, and one of them recently published, or had a contract at least with Routledge to publish their thesis. And yeah, I got in contact with them, and they were very keen on my idea for a book. Though they wanted me to change the title. So the title of my PhD thesis was Health Agency and Evolution of Consciousness. And the goal of my dissertation really was to look closely at the life history challenges of animals and try to think about what consciousness could give animals in their particular lives, not just as this all or nothing property, as people often think about consciousness, but rather about the individual subjective experiences that might be useful to have, right? So when it comes to, say, human consciousness, we typically assume that everyone has the same experience as ourselves even. But we know, psychologists have shown us, that even in humans, neurodiversity is quite striking. And when it comes to conditions like aphantasia, synesthesia, and the like, there can be great variations within humans, and it's often not obvious just from your own experience that there might be something very different from your own experience. And I really wanted to push our understanding of what I've called phenomenological complexity, these dimensions of consciousness that could be very different in animals evolutionarily far from us, that have branched off from our lineage a long time ago, say octopuses, for instance. Yeah, so that's the short story. And then obviously there's the longer story of how in my PhD, I came to be interested in animal consciousness. Originally, my PhD was meant to focus more on the evolution of agency and how organisms deal as Darwinian creatures with the sort of trade-off challenges they have to face. For any species, there's a question of where do they find their optimum? What is the optimal strategy they can pursue in their lives? And whether something is healthy or not, we can't just take a kind of human-centric point of view and say something like, think of this genus Antechinus in Australia, where the males die after a single breeding season. That might seem supremely unhealthy. But no, it's the optimal strategy they are pursuing given their ecological conditions. And really, in order to think about what's good for animals, what's the right design, you really have to focus very closely on the individual life history strategies. And now, because my partner, Heather Browning, just finished her PhD back then, and she wrote her thesis on animal welfare and animal consciousness by extension, because here welfare is at least typically defined as the balance of positive and negative mental experiences. I was motivated to really get close into this area, as well as Peter Godfrey Smith was one of my advisors, who wrote a book on the evolution of consciousness and very popular on octopus experiences, what they are like. And yeah, that really pushed me into this area to pursue this line of research myself.
Are you familiar with Kevin Mitchell and his latest book, Free Agents?
Yeah, I actually just interviewed him for my own podcast, and we had a great discussion where it turned out we actually share a very similar attitude, both about the origins of agency. In a way, his book tries to avoid talking about consciousness and talks mostly about free will, whereas in my book, I try to avoid talking about free will and talk mostly about consciousness. But actually, you might think that in a way we're both solving the same problem. So once you have conscious decision makers, you might say that is freedom in a sense. As agency increases over evolutionary time, now I locate this mostly in the animal lineage, that there was something at the major transitions of agency during the Cambrian explosion where animals got these recognizably animal-like bodies that are flexible, engage with their surroundings, have sensory organs, evaluate the world, make decisions, have to engage with other actors, with other agents. There you just get this rapid explosion of agency where you get decision makers, which makes consciousness worth having. And I think that's the important question to ask, where a lot of theories of consciousness focusing on humans often struggle to explain what the adaptive benefit of consciousness would be. Often it's just seen as some unnecessary byproduct that doesn't play much of a role. But I think that's a mistake. To take a very Darwinian approach here, I want to investigate what the benefits are of having conscious experiences versus not having them.
That life history approach that you mentioned, it seems like the exact approach that Mitchell takes to his argument for free will, like beginning with very simple singular cellular level organisms, which have a very limited degree of agency. And probably if you add on consciousness to that limited degree of experience, it does seem like the two are intertwined. As your freedom for decision making grows, there's a phenomenological aspect to that. What was the phenomenology term you mentioned, this scope?
As I talked about phenomenological complexity, I wouldn't say that single-celled organisms, even if they have a degree of agency, are conscious. I toyed with this early on in my PhD thesis, but the core goal of my framework was to say that one, for logical complexity that I talk a lot about in the book, but which can be easily understood as life history complexity. So it's the trade-offs organisms face during their life as a sort of design problem. And then the life history strategy is how do they implement the strategy? How do they make these trade-offs in their own lives? And of course, you might have organisms where this problem in a way is just solved once by natural selection itself and that they just implement it. But then in another way, you might think, look, organisms that make flexible decisions in their own life, routinely from moment to moment, they have to make trade-off decisions themselves. And now here, my argument was that just like fitness solves this problem in natural selection, organisms need something like a common currency to make these decisions. And this common currency is pleasure and pain or hedonic valence. So that idea has been influentially defended by Michel Cabon, a French physiologist and neuroscientist. And I really tried to give more substance to this view, which I think hasn't been given enough attention. So I would say for single-celled organisms, they have agency, definitely. But then on a multicellular scale, agency in a way had to be reinvented, right? When you have cellular organisms, they don't just automatically have agency, right? There is a loss of agency taking place on the individual cell level, and then the whole group becomes more of an agent, right? There's these multiple major transitions taking place from male collections to a genuine group, from a group towards a genuine individual, and then from an individual towards becoming more agent. And yeah, perhaps consciousness is it's something like the end point here, perhaps the richest form of agency we can have. But I don't see the evidence that single-cell organisms have the kind of common currency that would give them hedonic valence, at least.
Has your view been influenced by computational approaches to consciousness, like integrated information theory or active inference or any other predictive processing frameworks?
Yeah, integrated information theory in a way is both an inspiration and a rival, because I share the interest in providing a mathematical measure that's in a way simple and can enable us to rank organisms according to how much consciousness they have, that we can account for degrees of sentience. But where I disagree with integrated information theory for several reasons, but one is I think they try to be very neutral regarding the adaptive function of consciousness. They try to steer away from evolutionary thinking qua the motivation to provide an account of consciousness, a theory that can be used to answer whether some machine might be conscious, whether some artificial intelligence system might have consciousness, right? And that's a valuable motivation to have, of course, because we, as artificial intelligence is progressing at rapid rates, we want to be able to answer at which point maybe some of those systems should have morals that are sentient, might suffer, might have interests that deserve protection. But yeah, I don't see the need to declare unity, for instance, as this fundamental property of consciousness, where you might distinguish multiple properties of consciousness that all can vary in their degrees. And here I see the unity of conscious experience not really as something that's very important. If you think about, say, birds, they're sometimes discussed as a potential case for natural split brain patients where they might have two streams of consciousness. I think they're actually a bad example, because in the evolution from, say, featherless reptiles, our brains have actually taken a similar evolutionary trajectory to that of the human brain, where the two halves have become much more integrated again. So if we want to talk about natural split brains in the natural world, it's much better to talk about reptiles more generally, excluding avian reptiles and fishes. And here it seems entirely possible that there's two streams of consciousness, where one side, for instance, can sleep whilst the other one is awake. Dolphins, for instance, do that as well. And that's at least a potential evolutionary challenge, that you don't need complete unity for conscious experience. It might be useful to have a more disunified kind of experience. So think about synesthesia, for instance. How much unity do we want? Do we want all of our conscious experiences to blend into each other? That would be more unified, right? Why not see smells, for instance, in our visual field as particular colors? Why not have a particular aura associated with different people we know? Why don't we want sounds intruding into our conscious experience all the time? Right, for synesthetes, where these conscious experiences seem to blend extremely, they report that it's often very overwhelming, that they struggle to go about in the world. And yeah, I really took issue with this idea of the integrated information theory, that unity must be this fundamental property of consciousness, and then we can just assess how unified the information processing is essentially in different parts of the system, and then perhaaps that part that has the highest information integration is then the conscious part. I'm not too convinced by that. But formally, I think there's quite a few similarities with my approach, where I try to measure the life history complexity, what I call the pathological complexity of different species, and then use that not only to rank different species according to how conscious they are, but also to give us an indication of how their experiences may differ, right? Because the life history challenges of different organisms and different species can vary substantially. Take, for instance, the life history challenges of orangutans, who spend a lot of time in trees, compared to, say, small monkeys. Small monkeys don't have to worry typically about their weight on branches, how swinging through trees, their body would become an obstacle. They can be much more relaxed about that, whereas I think for large mammals like orangutans, if they're in trees, they have to have a much richer concept of self, of themselves in space, in order to avoid, falling off a tree, breaking a bone, just crashing into a branch by swinging around. And similarly, the different challenges, say, of animals that hunt for particular food sources that require a much richer sense of smell. Here, they would also be driven to have richer smell capacities. And so I tried to link the properties of phenomenological complexity with properties of pathological complexity in order to move away from consciousness as just an additional fact we may choose to explain, but can ignore typically in much of cognitive science, and rather see it as an explanatory factor where we can draw on a wealth of experimental paradigms in order to assess the likely phenomenological experiences of animals, and then use that data in order to make inferences about what the life history challenges are these animals face, and then we can investigate that in virtue of observations of their lives in the natural environments they live in. Partially, we can observe that also in captive environments, perhaps in zoos. But I wanted to develop this framework that could provide us with nice feedback between these different research areas and really to make progress in biology and include consciousness within the Darwinian revolution.
This sounds like it would fit in with Carl Friston and Mark Solms' active inference theory, which is a similar computational view of consciousness, but it's more Bayesian. And they argue that consciousness comes as a result of prediction error, which has that valence component that you mentioned, because you want to minimize error. And then it also explains some things we see in humans. If you're learning a new skill, lots of brain activity, and you're hyper-focused, and it's requiring a lot of cognitive resources, let's say you're learning to drive for the first time. And then once you practice that over and over again, it becomes more unconscious, right? Some people even report, if you're driving home late at night, it's a route you've done hundreds of times before, you might not even remember how you got home.
Yeah, great. I have a lot of sympathy for Mark Solms' take there. Now, Carl Friston has co-written with a lot of authors, some of which disagree with each other. So I'm not entirely sure how much I can grasp what his exact view is on how predictive processing is related to consciousness. But certainly for Mark Solms' book, I wasn't too sure how much the free energy principle actually added to his arguments there. And I'm a bit opposed to it, because as I see free energy principle and predictive processing frameworks, they're often proposed as these very radical ways of organizing scientific data. And in that way, they're similar to, say, the Darwinian approach of seeing organisms as fitness maximizers. And then often they seem to make radical claims about organisms just being prediction error minimizers, when they're not. Often, organisms will deliberately try to learn in virtue of making a lot of errors, qua ultimately trying to maximize fitness. In a way, I don't see how much this very general framework adds in addition to the traditional Darwinian framework. And now, don't get me wrong, a lot of what the brain does is trying to minimize errors, right? In virtue of how we deal with our visual perceptions, we don't want to have visual illusions appear in our visual perception all the time, right? So I think they just sometimes go too radical in their claims of trying to explain all of organismal activity, or almost in virtue of trying to minimize these prediction errors. So instead, my framework rather sees the basic problem as one of dealing with trade-offs that arise from the need to maximize fitness. And in order to deal with these trade-offs, you need a common currency. And here, hedonic valence helps us. So it does have an important role, similarly to that explained by Mark Solms, but I think almost more centrally, because it's so closely linked to the Darwinian problem of avoiding the harmful and pursuing the beneficial. I think the link to this basic principle is much closer than to a Bayesian framework. I could totally envision building very complex artificial intelligence that operates by Bayesian principles without the need for valence. I'm not sure that there is really a need to build this into a system that hasn't evolved by the principles of natural selection, because, of course, artificial systems don't have this need to pursue their own fitness. We might want to build artificial agents that have similar systems that evaluate their own needs and deal with trade-offs. But this will probably give us very different artificial intelligences than what we typically want artificial intelligence to be good for the purposes we design them to help us with the human tasks we are interested in. We don't want to replicate human intelligence. We want to build this complete other kind of intelligence, not hindered by the idiosyncrasies of the human mind that has evolved from animal minds that had to deal with this very basic hedonic way of engaging with the world.
Let's think about the phenomenology of reinforcement learning. So say you have an AI that's trained to maximize some reward parameter and also minimize some error parameter. And over time, it'll get better and better at doing that. And in a way, that's valence because it's positive to maximize the reward and it's negative to accumulate error. So then you can look at that and say, does this have its own phenomenology? And I think most people will say this is just all mechanistic. It doesn't need to have any subjective experience. And then to take the extreme opposite position, you could say that about humans as well. You could say that what we're doing under the hood, it's really all this mechanistic stuff. And one extreme version would be this philosophical zombies idea. You can be sure that you and yourself are conscious, but you can't exactly prove other people are. It's just, it makes sense to think, okay, they have more or less the same biology of you. They're acting the same as you. Like, you're granting them experience, but you can't prove it without experiencing it. So then I take that approach back to the artificial intelligence idea. And I think, okay, so we can't prove it's conscious. And any tests that it could seemingly pass, like these large language models, can spit out phrases that sound quite human. And most people will say, this is just statistical learning. It's not actually experiencing anything. But then I take it again back to that question of the zombie. Even with humans, if we can't prove it in any definitive sense that other life is conscious, then how would we ever reconcile that with artificial systems? Could it be that something like reinforcement learning, especially if you're selecting over generations, if you're selecting for versions of this model that are more successful over many training cycles in a natural selection-like fashion, could that then replicate this evolutionary principle of hedonic valence you're discussing?
Yeah, I think that's a good thought experiment to think about, where perhaps artificial intelligences in the future that have vastly more complex forms of learning than just basic reinforcement learning, which of course can be found in single-celled organisms that we don't want to grant consciousness to, that there we could get close to something like a kind of quasi-sentience, quasi-hedonic valence. And I want to distinguish here very strongly between hedonic valence and valence, as it's often talked about in this ambiguous way of just any evaluation going on in a cognitive system. Because clearly in our brains, most of the evaluation that's going on is unconscious, right? And I want to distinguish there the unconscious valence processes from those that are ultimately presented in this hedonic way in order to have this common currency where things are being compared. And I think perhaps in principle, we might build artificial intelligences like that in the future that have quite complex common currencies in order to make different difficult trade-off decisions. Now, I'm not sure whether they would necessarily be conscious. One argument that's very commonly given in the literature on the evolution of consciousness is that the wetware might be quite important. Just replicating the functional architecture alone might not be enough for conscious experience. It might be that it's due to the particular way the nervous system works, this kind of wet electricity that might be different in artificial intelligence system. Now, I'm not too sure that must be true. It's more that we can't know at the moment. And if we want to build artificial agents, perhaps, that we could be the most certain about having conscious experiences, we probably would want them to be as close to us in terms of, the hardware, as well as just the functional architecture. And how we would build this is, of course, partially an open question. But I think complex forms of learning could give us something like quasi-sentience, probably more like Simona Ginsberg and Evia Blanca argue, complex forms of associative learning. I think that has been more closely linked to consciousness. So if you run tests on the connection between learning and consciousness, it seems that some forms of learning depend on conscious experience. And associative learning has shown to be at least closer linked than reinforcement learning, which seems to be, strictly speaking, irrelevant. Consciousness seems relevant for being capable of these. But tests like linking the sound of a bell and then being exposed to a particular stimuli, a few seconds later, some animals haven't been able, and humans as well, haven't been able to make this connection unless it was consciously perceived. And so it does seem like consciousness plays an important role here for some types of learning. And we're currently, as a research community, trying to really zoom in on which types of learning are important here.
When thinking about very diverse forms of consciousness, like an octopus, is the argument that even though their experiences might be different in this fundamental bioelectricity sense, they're made of the same stuff and there's convergent evolution, or there's shared evolutionary lineage going all the way back to even before vertebrates split off, whatever the basic building blocks were are the same. And that's why you'd see perhaps consistency between humans and octopuses and our ability to be conscious in ways that artificial intelligence is not.
Yeah, so someone like Peter Godfrey Smith, Evia Blanca, Simona Ginsberg, they think consciousness probably independently arose in octopuses and the human lineage, and there wasn't a common ancestor that also had consciousness. Now, I am more favorable, at least, towards the view that these first ancestors might have something like the first sparks of subjective experience, some very rudimentary degrees of agency, and more like annelid creatures, more worm-like creatures that were, in a way, more plant-like, right? Not all animals are very mobile and active. Some live more like plants, right? If you think about corals and a lot of the world of underwater, there is a lot of animals living plant lifestyles, and they are more sessile in a way. But nevertheless, they have some forms of movement, some degrees of agency, and it's probably here that we'll have the future uncertainty regarding whether they are subjective experience or not, and this boundary, we won't have anything like a bright line that we can draw in the future. It's probably going to be more gradual. And then you get something like convergent evolution towards these richer forms of sentience that are perhaps morally more relevant, which might have been lost in the more sessile forms of life. I think octopuses just seem to have this striking capacity for agency. It's extremely rich, where you might even attribute conscious experience to the individual arms, right? Where individual arms have more nerve cells than, say, insects, bumblebees, perhaps, that we now also consider as possible candidates for consciousness, for sentient experience. Why then not give octopus arms this capacity, right? Why do we have to assume that just because in humans, consciousness there's only one stream of consciousness. Why couldn't there be multiple ones in octopuses? It might be very hard to think about, but that's probably where we're at. From a Darwinian perspective, I don't think there's anything inherently that we can say about that, against it rather. We shouldn't focus too much on human introspection as revealing sort of the necessary structure of how consciousness must be as a natural phenomenon.
I just did a podcast with Lars Chitka, whose work you might be referencing on bees. And we talked about all the cognitive capacities of bees, which I think have been known for decades. So like learning and memory and concept of number and things like that. But then we also got into emotion territory. And I'm in the affective neuroscience camp of people like Mark Solms and Antonio Damasio, believing that affect is more fundamental to consciousness than anything cognitive. You don't need cortex. Consciousness might be rooted more so in the brainstem. So I was thinking, okay, brainstem, that clearly only applies to vertebrates and maybe more complex forms of life than insects. And then he was arguing that they do in fact experience pleasure and pain, and even social forms of pleasure and pain, exhibiting grieving-like behaviors if the queen bee dies, for example.
Yeah, I'm very strongly also in the affective neuroscience camp with someone like Panksepp at the very origins, I think, with these basic forms of affect. I think they're very evolutionary old, something like the seeking system, the fear system. I think he was right about that, how that might look now. It's a bit of a simplistic picture perhaps he offered, but I think he was on the right track there. I think it's not just anthropomorphizing to assign that to animals that seem very simple. It's just that those different factors correspond to very basic Darwinian challenges that are just shared by much of life. And now you mentioned Lars Chitka. I met him earlier this year for the first time at a conference in India, where we were both invited to meet the Dalai Lama and talk about animal consciousness for a couple of days. That was great. And yeah, his research on bees is groundbreaking there, where he really pushes the boundaries of what we thought bees were capable of doing. They're smart, they have complex evaluative capacities that, yeah, I might have not, maybe even believed if I had heard about it, say, 5 years ago. So the scientific boundaries of what we think other animals are capable of, I think, are continuously being pushed. And sometimes skeptics look for continuously new hurdles that animals are meant to be able to jump through in order to be granted moral status. And it's difficult, because if we were to grant consciousness to insects, that might question a lot of how we approach the world, say, insecticides and farming, pesticides, that might not be as morally unquestionably okay anymore. Yeah, I think his research is really great. I got recently a new grant to investigate those evaluative capacities further. In fact, I used his research as one of the core forms of defending the pathological complexity thesis that consciousness evolved for biological agents to deal with pathological complexity, this computational explosion of life history, complexity challenges that they have to face off against, this explosion and trade-offs that animals have to deal with, where his team showed that bees are able to trade off different stimuli very well against each other. For instance, the value of a nutritional sugar solution versus the heat on a platform and how damaging that might be to their bodies. And that is quite convincing evidence that these perhaps small and seemingly humble creatures have a capacity to make these complex hedonic trade-offs. And I find that at least quite convincing.
I'm tempted to then look at that as a computational framework. Okay, there's some reward, there's some punishment, and they don't have to just be one form of reward, one form of punishment. Like in Panksepp's basic emotion theory way, you could have these qualitative distinctions that are innate. So you might have hunger, thirst, bodily pain, social or emotional pain, like all of these different things that you could be evaluating under some utility maximizing process under the hood. Whether or not you're consciously aware of that, would you say that's what's going on?
Yeah, I don't think that the way decision making works is that all the different dimensions of perhaps relevant factors ultimately translated into some qualitative feeling, and then they're all being compared against in this hedonic form. That would get us back to the kind of Cartesian thinking where there's a little decider making all decisions, and it would just not be computationally viable. So a lot of the processes that are going on are trying to make these decisions before they get to anything like a final decision maker. And it's only with some decisions that this information is ultimately being presented in this hedonic way. So a lot of the work is already being done at multiple decision points across the entire body. Your nervous system is making complex decisions of which information is relevant, which can be discarded, which evaluative factors should ultimately perhaps be relevant for decision making. And it's this complex interplay that it's hard to understand, but perhaps once we get close to it, we'll be able to distinguish unconscious affect versus conscious affect. And that's really the challenge now for consciousness research, to really understand, yeah, when and why something is here consciously evaluated versus not, and how much is going on below the surface, right? And that will be the challenge, I think, for the next, say, decades, probably.
Yeah. When you say under the surface, would you think about that in a neural networks type way, where for vision, for example, you have neurons detecting low-level features, such mm-hmm. as whether a line is horizontal or vertical, and then you sum up a bunch of those and you start to get maybe collections of neurons that fire for diagonal lines, and you can sum up those features to get something like faces or scene recognition or anything more high level. And then one simple way of thinking about it could be that there's just some cutoff for if you're below a certain threshold in the network, if you're detecting only low level features, those don't rise to conscious awareness. And then it's above some threshold, then you start experiencing it.
Yeah, I think that's a very useful model to think about what a lot of what our brain does. I think that's a very good way, perhaps, of getting at it. I'm not sure it is simplifying it too much. Perhaps it's too much trying to think about how we're building artificial intelligence system and then trying to argue that the human brain, qua also being successful in similar tasks, must function by the same way. But to a first approximation, I would say that is pretty much how it's happening. There's only a certain level at which information is useful to be represented in a conscious form. And then there's probably some feedback where information can be ignored, where you might pay more attention to something, and then that information enters your conscious experience more, versus you can also ignore some factors, because conscious experience at times, of course, can be overwhelming. And just because something is in your visual field, in your, say, this whole conscious arena of smells and tastes and the like, it doesn't mean it gets attention necessarily. So I would want at least to make room there for how attention can also play a kind of filtration role.
That seems to highlight another reason why we wouldn't resort to some domain general information integration theory type theory. So if you have these qualitative distinctions, as you mentioned, with something like synesthesia, not only could it be overwhelming if all your sensations are just blended into one, but it loses its functional utility from the evolutionary perspective that each sensation originally evolved for. So innately, then, you have some sort of qualitative distinction. And you could almost think of that as separate modules for different types of experiences, maybe running in parallel. And then in the case of having five senses, five running in parallel gives you some sort of convergent validity of maybe if you're only experiencing one or two senses, it could be just error. You could be hallucinating something. But if you can touch it and see it and hear it and smell it all at the same time, that's probably actually there right in front of you.
Yeah, at least for humans, we often don't rely on our non-visual senses all too much. The other ones are typically underdeveloped. I think, for instance, of dogs, we often assume, oh, yes, dogs can, of course, smell much better than humans, but the olfactory bulb, it's smaller than ours. So I was at a smell conference in Tanzania, and interestingly, neuroscientists working on human smell were quite, we're trying to challenge these just common assumptions in the folk that a human smell is this under this inferior capacity. Just we're not training our smell capacity. Similarly, our touch capacities can probably be trained, our hearing capacities. Now, of course, we know stories like humans that lose their vision and then become able to echolocate objects in the world, right? That seems like this incredible newfound ability. We're almost using the parts of the brain that once dealt with visual information. They become co-opted to use the information coming in via echolocation and then use that to create something like a visual field of the objects around them. They often report that the way they use echolocation, it gives them something like an image of the world. And yeah, synesthetes, I think here, have a different problem where their senses overlap with each other. But I think they can also be stronger. So often synesthetes report stronger smell capacities, for instance. A woman I met was able to smell diseases and see them as distinct colors on different people. So she worked as a nurse, and in virtue of that, she was able to categorize different smells in terms of different pathologies. And then her husband at some point, I think it was Alzheimer, she had this awful, her husband had this awful stench to her, and she recognized it's the same one for these other patients. And she realized, even though none of the tests showed that he had Alzheimer, she was able to detect the smell earlier than that. Yeah, we really have to think about the trade-offs in how conscious information is being presented. Things can have certain disadvantages, but they can also give us different advantages, and they can trade off against each other. And plausibly, for the very different life history strategies different animals pursue, there's going to be very different optima in how their conscious experience is being presented to them, right? So think, for instance, of dogs. Why shouldn't very distinct smells appear as colors in their visual experience? Would that really give them a disadvantage? I'm not so sure about that. Think of wolves in a natural environment, pigs perhaps, right? But it's hard to know, right? We want perhaps to assume that it's just normal to not see smells as colors in our visual field. But perhaps for other animals, that would be a useful way of presenting the information here.
Synesthesia started to make more sense to me once I started to realize what's actually going on under the hood with regard to the way that our brain processes chemoreceptors. So whether it's for vision or for olfaction, it's the same chemical sensors that neurons are signaling to the different part of the brain, right? So then if those become cross-wired, doesn't exactly matter whether the chemical cascade was triggered by a photon or triggered by a chemical that we would smell. It's more or less the same process. And there was a debate that highlighted this between Mark Solms and Lisa Feldman Barrett last year. I don't know if you heard this. So they were arguing about the origins of emotion and the neuroscience of emotion. And Solms was in Panksepp's camp of basic emotion theory, where you have innate qualitative distinctions between different basic emotions. And Lisa's is more her constructed theory of emotion, where you have valence and arousal as fundamental affect, but then any qualitative distinctions, like the difference between bodily pain and hunger and thirst, all of these things are just cognitive processing, top-down context. And they were going back and forth about it, not making much progress. And it wasn't until the end when Lisa argued, look, all of these qualitative distinctions that we see in the brain are the result of top-down processing. Even something discerning olfaction from vision, because under the hood, there's similar sensory neurons relying on chemical signals. It's only with the benefit of top-down construal that we can say these are in fact separate systems. And that seemed to end the debate as a agree to disagree, because Solms took that as evidence of, okay, if you're saying that emotions are basically divided in fundamentally the same sense as sensation is, then it's just a difference in how we're phrasing this. Like, you're saying that because qualitative distinctions are construed and using this top-down processing, then they don't exist in some fundamental sense. And he's saying they do exist, and it's certainly the most fundamental for perception. And I'm arguing it's at least as fundamental for emotion. So if those fall into the same category, that seemed to resolve the debate for both of them.
Interesting. Yeah. No, I heard about this debate, and that gives us progress, at least. I still think there's something perhaps wrong about the idea that all emotions are just constructed. Perhaps it depends on how it's being phrased. But yeah, I'm much closer there in my agreement with Mark Solms. I really think of basic valence and arousal as ways in where we might place emotions. But basic emotions have a kind of reality without top-down processing, I really think. It's a way information is being presented to an agent. And when we think about more complex emotions, I think the view by Lisa Feldman Barrett rings much more true. When we have these cross-cultural analyses of emotions, it really does seem like for complex emotions, it's hard to deny that there is this massive diversity. And that makes sense. If we humans can train their basic conscious faculties, think of smell, right? We can train our smell capacity to make more distinctions. Someone who's a wine taster, for instance, can train their faculty for distinguishing different wines, where they come from, what the ingredients were. Whereas for most people, they won't be distinguished, the $2 wine from the $500 wine, right? And there, I think we get more of the top-down processing, where there's more conscious control, fine-tuning of the information. But I really want to say that the basic conscious ingredients, they're much more bottom-up here. So yeah, it's interesting to hear that they found some agreement, that it's more about the way they framed the discussion, that actually there isn't as much of a fundamental disagreement there. I should watch the debate.
I think it was as much of a fundamental disagreement, but it was like, let's fundamentally agree to disagree, because if we're not going to even come to consensus on perception, then no way we'll do it with a more complex process like emotion. Walter, I want to pivot to applied ethics and animal welfare.
Sure.
I'll get right to my biggest question. So there seems to be underlying this idea of the more complex an animal's conscious experience is, the more regard we should have for its welfare. And that makes sense. Like, the more capacity an animal has to experience pain, the more we should prioritize minimizing that pain and handling them safely, especially if it's animals processed for food. But then the biggest counterexample that I've been presented with to that view is, okay, imagine an alien intelligence vastly more complex than human experience, and our experience of pain compared to them was minimal. Does that mean that it could be ethical for them to just harvest us as food or disregard our conscious experiences because they would view us just like simple animals?
Yeah, very good. A similar version of the argument is just to say that it's an anthropocentric point of view that, oh, of course, but humans just end up on top and we're still much more important than any other animals. And yeah, I heard sometimes the argument given against my view that it's still anthropocentric, but I was able to convince the critics here that my view isn't going to actually tell us that humans have more complex evaluative experiences necessarily than other animals, right? There's these different dimensions of conscious experience, and different animals will vary along those dimensions, right? So a peregrine falcon has a much richer sense of vision, presumably, than humans. It's much richer visual acuity, where they can see, say, a mouse from a kilometer, perhaps, in the sky, which we humans wouldn't be able to do. But yeah, I don't think intelligence has actually much to do with it. I don't think the emotional affective range of someone with an extremely high IQ is going to be that much different from someone, say, with an IQ of 80 in a human population. And because of that, I think it also raises the question of whether animals couldn't just have, perhaps some animals at least, couldn't have a more larger range of affective experiences, because in humans, we, in the evolution of human barter and trade, it became more important to form these non-hedonic value associations, where we didn't think anymore in terms of how good does something feel to us, and then we just pursue it. But rather, in the long term, this will pay off for me. And it's not really hedonic, right? This is where we get the distinction of type 1 and type 2 cognition, thinking fast and thinking slow, hot and cold thinking. I think there's really something onto this distinction, where humans almost evolved to become less hedonic. And because of this, I think you might even say that some animals then have this greater hedonic experience. Now, that's not a close case, but it's certainly an option we should take serious. And so I think it is entirely possible that if you take something like maybe dogs, pigs, whales, dolphins, they might have richer emotional experiences. They might have a richer, a more extreme capacity for suffering and welfare. And so with aliens, they might be much smarter than us. But what would be the benefit of having a much vaster range of emotional experiences? There is going to be a trade-off here, right? And if you don't make more trade-offs, say, it's probably not useful to have a greater welfare range, because you don't need to make as many distinctions. If these aliens have to deal with much more complex trade-off decisions, perhaps they have also then this greater welfare range. And maybe they do have a greater capacity for pleasure, but then probably also greater capacity for suffering. And I think that's just a bullet we have to bite. Now, certainly when it comes to humans, typically we don't want to say that different humans matter more, right? So a kind of utilitarian ethics typically says we all matter equally, but in a way that's not quite true. It's more that all of our interests are valued equally. But if someone has a greater capacity for pleasure, then it might be better to give that person, say, more resources, or that animal more resources, in order to get to those higher levels. Say an animal that really likes to play with, to be intellectually stimulated with complex toys and puzzles, say in a zoo. Maybe that those animals, we should give them these very complex toys, right? And it's a difficult moral conundrum, certainly, to think about how to deal with questions like interspecies ethics. I'm currently involved in research on thinking about how we should deal with animal farming. So think, for instance, of fishes, right? There's billions of fish being farmed out of the seas compared to a still very large number of, say, cows, but much smaller than that. And then the question is, if you just take an egalitarian approach and say they all matter the same, then it would seem we shouldn't fish. We should perhaps only farm cows. And similarly for insects, I think the egalitarian view starts to become more absurd. It starts to become harder to maintain. And you really need to recognize that gradations of sentience actually matter morally, because otherwise you wouldn't, I don't think anyone would want to say a single bee matters as much as a cow, say, right? For that, I think very few would say that we should be egalitarians there. But if you ask people about cows versus, say, minks versus small mammals, often there you get a much more egalitarian answer. They seem similar enough. But once you go that small to insects, doubt is starting to creep in.
I'm surprised you say that across different sized mammals that it's similar enough. I would think that the general heuristic would be the larger they are, the more we want to prioritize their well-being. Mm. And an extreme example I can think of is something like elephants versus dogs. And that might seem to break the rule yeah. because we have a great affinity for dogs. But I'm wondering, is that just a consequence of familiarity and it's a cultural thing? Or do we also believe that dogs have a greater potential for sentience or this emotional experience than a larger mammal?
Yeah, I'm not entirely clear on how much research there's been done on the brain development of dogs in their effective range, because their brains, as far as I know, have become smaller from their wild counterparts, and wolves have larger brains. Wolves seem to be better at solving complex cognitive tasks. So if you just take an intelligence-based view, you might think wolves matter more morally than in terms of their individual interests. But perhaps that's not quite right, because in virtue of interacting with humans, certainly dogs have become much better at expressing their emotions, in applying theory of mind thinking, where they really get close to understanding human expressions, right? Showing emotions in their own faces. So I think it's very reasonable to think that dogs actually have a greater effective range and capacity than wolves. Now, that will depend, of course, on the breed. Maybe a small Chihuahua doesn't have that range, right? But certainly in the evolution of dogs, I think the effective dimension has become much more important. While I wouldn't say that in elephants, that must be poorer. Elephants have very complex social hierarchies and networks, family dynamics, where it really seems like their evaluative capacities, they seem to be similarly rich to our human ones, where they can be depressed, where they can have anger issues and the like. And in a way, I partly agree with the idea that mammals do seem to be quite similar. The mammals just have similar emotional responses. And I would say that their experiences are similar. There would be differences in richness for sure, but I think there are these basic similarities that you get there. And you wouldn't have in, say, fishes. Fishes just seem different, which doesn't mean they don't have emotional experiences. I think they do, but I think from the sort of folk perspective, if you just ask people in the streets, we have a closer affinity there to mammals because their behavior just is more similar to our own, and their emotions seem to be more close to our own.
That's a nice edge case, because I think that this mammalian similarity might trump even the cognitive complexity argument. Mm. I think octopi would have a richer experience than, say, a mouse. But we know that even from the way that drugs like antidepressants have been developed, it's usually tested on rodent models, and there's enough neural similarity between them and humans and all mammals that we know they experience pain and pleasure in very similar ways. And clearly, octopuses do as well, but they probably evolved their own different neurotransmitter systems to do this, and it's just maybe experienced in a vastly different way, and probably a more complex way compared to rodents. But my guess is that the similarity, the oxytocin-based care, would influence our moral judgments over that more than this system two, like slow, detached, okay, octopi are more complex, so this they earn these many more moral points.
Yeah, I think there's almost an opposite reaction where with documentaries like My Octopus Teacher, all kinds of articles coming out about octopuses and books, there's been this kind of hype recently where many people think of octopuses as something like something akin to humans, these alien-like creatures that perhaps need equal protection. So there has been a lot of overhype of their intelligence, and that has, I think, partially led to thinking about them as deserving perhaps almost equal status to humans.
I'll jump on that to modify what I said then. Okay, so the idea would be that our moral deservingness that we award to animals is in precise proportion to how human similar we view they are. So at a biological level, that's most true of mammals, but maybe once we learn more about octopuses or really anything, the idea is the more they're framed as human-like, the more we start to care.
Mm. I think there's something right about that where for a lot of properties, we think if they're more human, then we think of them as deserving more moral protections. And my octopus teacher often, there is very anthropocentric talk going on in how the octopus is being presented as almost like a human that we can engage in. They might just have these very different bodies, but perhaps their minds are very similar. And that's a legitimate worry. One objection to the sentientist view is that we focus on affective experience because we have affective experience, but maybe we should care about something else. Maybe that's anthropocentric. I don't really think about it as being anthropocentric because I think it's shared by so much more of life than just us. And it's just a lucky coincidence that we have affective experiences that make our life typically go well, make it feel pleasurable and good. Not necessarily, of course. Many people suffer from depression, and then having consciousness might not seem that great at all. And yeah, so I think there's something, or at least, about this anthropocentric stance that we continue to have to fight, because some animals are just going to look very unsympathetic. Insects, cockroaches, people are not going to want to attribute their moral status. Whereas when we have bees, they look cute and everything, and then we're probably more likely going to be attributing moral status there. But maybe it's going to be similar to similar to rats. Maybe rats aren't the best example, but say crows, ravens that have been seen as these plague birds, terrible, annoying. People, farmers wish that they would just all die and that they're all stupid. But then the work of researchers like Nikki Clayton that have shown how intelligent these birds are have led to something like a U-turn, where now we think of these birds as, oh, they should be protected. We shouldn't just shoot them on sight. They're very smart. But yeah, I think there's also then a bit too much focus on intelligence alone. But yeah, I think we're moving away from just thinking about how smart animals are and more towards, do they have evaluative emotional capacities?
This is what I was trying to get at with the alien question, because if you ask people to justify why they rate certain animals as having less value than others, usually they don't say it's just because humans are on top and these are more human and some are less human. Like, they'll get at that in this roundabout way by talking about intelligence or affective capacity, and we humans just happen to be on the top. But then if you give them this alien counterexample, probably very few people are going to say, yeah, I'm going to sacrifice my life to this alien with a greater consciousness. So then it does seem to be that there's something anthropocentric at the heart of it. And that makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. Like, why would our morals evolve if not to protect us in the final analysis? And even something like a comparison between a bee and a cockroach, a bee is almost more infantile, right? It has the big eyes, it's fuzzy, which maybe reminds us of other small mammals, which sort of remind us of infants. And all of this to me seems to loop back to this anthropocentric morality. And I'm not exactly criticizing that, because it makes sense to me that it evolved.
Yeah, I think we're moving away from anthropocentrism slowly, more this the sentientist way of seeing the world. And certainly there is something partially remaining anthropocentric about that, in virtue of how we probably still think that human sentience has this greater capacity. Luckily, even if we become sentientists, then humans, we can still prioritize them. But of course, there's two responses. Firstly, we're not at all living like sentientists at the moment, even if other animals have a lower status there. We're not treating them according to that status at all, where in industrial farms, their welfare is just being ignored mostly, right? So even if you give someone less moral relevance, that doesn't mean they have none. right? Mm-hmm. Their moral interests, their feelings still matter. And so the alien case, I think, is quite interesting because similarly, under which conditions would it actually be good for those aliens that we would sacrifice us? How much would that improve their actual welfare? Having this greater welfare capacity presumably also means that these aliens could suffer more, right? Perhaps it's actually not that great to have humans. If you compare dogs, for instance, I would happily say that a dog probably across a lifetime, they might have more positive effect of experience than humans on balance, if you compare that to, yeah, these just the general states of maybe boredom, sadness, disappointment humans feel. But if you look at your golden retriever, they seem to be much more in going through this ecstatic life, almost like they're on ecstasy nonstop, right? So just because you have a greater capacity for effective experience doesn't mean that your interests necessarily matter more. Maybe we need to give humans access to the Soma drug. Maybe what's that one from Brave New World that just makes everyone more happy. That would probably be great if there was something like this without side effects. And yeah, that could perhaps be worth something to think about as a moral urgent issue. Yeah, so I don't think the answers are very straightforward in these debates. But yeah, I think it is always useful to question whether we are not being too anthropocentric at the moment.
I'm wondering where the utilitarian style or base belief even comes from, because it seems more almost like an axiom from which to ground your morals in than something that's usually defended. I know it sounds silly to say because I don't disagree with it, but mm-hmm. I prioritize pleasure over pain in the first place, or why prioritize animals who can experience that more over those who can't. One reason might be just because it so strongly violates our intuitions, but I don't see much questioning of it in the normal philosophical sense of if you have a belief, it's grounded in a whole series of arguments. It seems more like the arguments generally start from that shared agreement.
In a way, I think about it, it's almost like a rejection of the metaphysical dubiousness going on in a lot of ethics and in a lot of moral theories that try to just build obligations in almost these castles in the sky. Whereas for utilitarianism, they just take something that already exists in all sentient creatures, that they have interests, that they have pleasure and pain. And I don't mean pleasure and pain here in the sense of, as I saw, utilitarianism is often criticized. You just, oh yeah, there are these pleasures of, I don't know, eating some fancy food, and then there's pains of being stepping on a glass. No, it's all of the positive experiences, whatever they may be, and all of the negative experiences. And almost all animals, unless there's something going very wrong, pursue the good feelings and try to avoid the negative feelings, right? So it's qua those agents themselves wanting these states that they matter. They matter for those individuals. It doesn't matter morally for them necessarily. That's a different question you can ask. But for any individual, those states matter to them. And then for the utilitarian, all we really do is to say, look, if that's the case, then why not just try to make the world more like how individuals want it? Why not focus on the states that the actual individuals actually like? And that's, I would say, the way utilitarians then try to approach these issues, by trying to stay more grounded to the actual psychology of individual agents, whether they're humans or animals.
And how do you respond to the extreme criticisms of utilitarianism where it's, imagine a hamster wheel of suffering, and you take just a single individual in unimaginable pain, but through that somehow they are able to reduce suffering for everyone else, and it nets out such that more people are experiencing more good at the expense of this one. And many people will say that's still immoral.
I'm not a big fan of very abstract philosophical experiments typically, because you can just build a thought experiment in order to make a particular position look bad, but I can build another thought experiment to make it look good again. So an experiment like that, you might think, under some circumstances, say, take something like putting someone in prison who has committed some horrible crime, right? Prison, in a way, can be seen as a kind of torture. And if it's a very famous case that people follow on the news, say, criminal has been put behind bars for his crimes against humanity or something like this, typically then humans do derive pleasure from that. And that seems to be fine. The question is, what about innocence, right? That's typically what people would be opposed to. We don't want to make innocent people suffer for the sake of the benefits of others. And here, I think the main objection you can give is that no one wants to live in a world where you might just be picked as a random person that hasn't done anything negative to society, have a lot of suffering inflicted upon you just for the sake of others. People would be very afraid in such a society. Probably wouldn't happen in a utilitarian world. So yeah, I don't really think that would happen. If our psychology was like, oh, whatever, but that's not our human psychology. So I don't think it's really a thought experiment that any utilitarian would endorse.
Now, in terms of people's thought out morals, they generally don't seem to endorse these things. But if you look at behavior, we do constantly seem to prioritize small personal pleasures over hypothetical suffering of others. I take it as a great thing that I can get cheap clothing. For all I know, this was produced in a factory across the world, exploiting workers in harsh conditions. And similarly, pleasure from eating meat. Some people think out their morals all the way back to, like, how does this fit into, say, my utilitarian ethic, and choose not to eat meat. But I think most people don't do that. And most people, it's not even like you're constantly living in cognitive dissonance of, oh, I shouldn't be doing this, but it just tastes so good. Most people just think about it and brush it aside. And it's, yeah, but it doesn't bother me that much. And that's the end of that. Where does that come from?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, I think, is just cognitive dissonance. I think we all have it. We all have cognitive dissonance when we don't all have complete consistency among all of our beliefs. I just don't think that's actually true. And then we all have, of course, a lack of willpower, acrasia. Many of us think, oh, we should eat healthy and go to the gym, and yet we still don't do it, even if we recognize it's the good thing for ourselves. So we typically neglect our future selves in virtue of the current desires of our present selves. So that's very similar, I think, to when we focus on our current self against the interest of, say, a Bangladeshi worker in a sweatshop, perhaps, or an animal in a farm somewhere miles away. And yet, similar to when we think about ourselves, we can recognize we shouldn't do that. Similarly, in those cases, we can say, yeah, I wish I wasn't eating meat right now, right? And a lot of people do that. A lot of people say it would be better if I didn't eat meat, or if those types of farms didn't exist. But we don't have unlimited willpower. And that, I think, that is important to recognize. So when people talk about utilitarianism being over-demanding, because seemingly you could just sacrifice almost all of your, say, income to help people in a poor country, they would derive much more value from that. And that's just not our human psychology, firstly. And secondly, utilitarianism isn't a deontological framework. The notion of obligations and rights, that's not really something utilitarianism has to worry all too much about. You can say that the world would be better if it was like this, if my actions were like this, but then it can just be an unfortunate psychological fact that we might not be able to overcome our more selfish desires completely. And that's fine. No one demands of you that you're a different person. Now, if your own selfish desires are so harmful, they're really causing a lot of harm, of course, that's something to investigate and so forth. But yeah, the way I think about it often is that utilitarianism is actually more of a political philosophy. So in the political philosophy debates, utilitarianism is often discussed as something, say, opposed to libertarianism or egalitarianism, which of course aren't individual moral frameworks typically. But we can think of how we would organize society in order for individuals to flourish, to have high well-being, in order not to have just seemingly senseless laws that are based on principles that don't seem to serve anyone. So when Bentham tried to create this utilitarian movement, when you had these Benthamites in government that tried to follow his principles, what they were trying to do is get rid of laws that just seemed ludicrous, that seemed to benefit no one and just create more harm and just make society run on more sensible principles. And similarly, we can think here about animals as, how should we organize society in a way that benefits not just humans, but also other animals? How can we get them the kind of political recognition that their interests also matter? And we are a far way away from that, right? But I think that's an important step to think about in the future. That how do we put animal interests more into our legal frameworks?
And in communicating this philosophy for animal consciousness and communicating the richness of animal experience, you're hoping that will tap into people's moral intuitions or just sense of empathy of, wow, this is, they're much more complex than I realized, I care for them type thing.
Yeah, definitely. Part of the motivation was also to recognize human neurodiversity, right? Humans can be so different and we should recognize this diversity and make society more inclusive. Say those with autism, you can make society more inclusive for them so that they can flourish, contribute to society and their skill sets that are unique. A lot of perspectives can be useful here. And similarly then for animals, once we recognize this diversity, we can think about, yeah, that animals aren't so different from us after all. They have interests. They might be different from our interests, but we don't want other beings to be harmed. And yeah, as animal cognition, animal minds, animal affective neuroscience is making progress, I think the attitudes of humans towards them are changing rapidly. So I'm quite hopeful here that we'll have a major change in the future. And already we're seeing, of course, the in number of vegans, vegetarians increasing everywhere, at least in Western countries. And I think that trend is going to continue.
Thank you, Walter. Great talking with you.
Likewise. Thanks for the invite.